You're listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn, and tonight is episode 99, Maccabee Life Between the Wars. And what we're going to be looking at is the history and meta-history around a body of work released by musicians Al Stewart and Lawrence Juber in 1995. And if you'd like to join us, you can come out to the chat room at bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. That's bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. And this was one of those pieces of music that came out, and there's a term in the music industry about being a musician's musician. And what that means is there were always, you know, musicians that may not have gotten the popular acclaim, but among other musicians, they were held in a very, very high regard. And these were the people that played with everyone, who did very innovative things, even though they may have not have sold a lot of records. What they did totally changed the game rules of either they were using new technologies, new techniques, or just merging different types of music in a way that hadn't been done before. And so as somebody who did pursue music for a very long time and did, you know, I had a recording studio for a while. I did touring as a sound engineer and a musician, was, you know, primarily a guitar player, but played lots of other instruments. But Al Stewart was one of those people that came out in the music industry in the mid-70s. In what was the heyday of the FM radio prog rock revolution, if you will, progressive rock and roll stations that moved away from AM radio amplitude modulation to the new FM, as the old song goes, no static at all, and you had stereo FM for those new stereo sound systems that started coming into being in the 1960s, moving from single speaker to multiple speaker stereo, new recording techniques where we're moving from single track recording of Edison's invention to multi-track recording with 32 track 2-inch Studerdex, for example, have multiple tracks to work with, in these huge mixing consoles where you could just do overdubs for days. And then the quality of recording had gotten so good with the microphones, the electronics, where you didn't get all that weird sound, distortion, buzzing, radio stations coming in through your guitar amplifier, you know, those kind of things, where the audio industry just hit another level there in the mid-70s. And one of the people to emerge in this was a gentleman by the name of Al Stewart. And I, of course, you know, followed his work from that point on. Again, at the time, my brother was still in radio in the 70s, and he was transitioning a radio station into a new rock and roll format, if you will. And it was funny, at the time there was a show called WKRP in Cincinnati that was basically the same type of thing that was going on there at the local radio station that my brother was managing, and as doing format change and working in the community, but at the same time bringing in all of this new music that a lot of the people in the area did not want any part of. So when I did the show last week on Huey P. Long, one of the things that kept popping up in the comment was, we all need to really take a look at the 1930s and just revisit that time between the two wars and all the changes that were happening on the international stage. And like I was talking about last week, Mr. Mike King has done some incredible research of looking at that period, especially in his work on the Rothschild Planet. But, you know, when you start to see what was happening in all the different countries, and you see the global chessboard, and suddenly all that history that was compartmentalized and taught at different levels of your education suddenly starts to make another pattern of, oh, well, this war was related to this war, which was related to this banking law, which was related to this, you know, change in country, etc. And all these events start taking on a completely new dimension. And I pulled out this album, Life Between the Wars, or just Between the Wars, that came out in 1995, and was really struck by what I heard with these eyes and ears, you know, looking at the lyric sheet and looking at the videos and listening to the music and the top, and was really shocked by my reaction of, well, I don't, you know, I used to love that song, but I don't agree with any of that. And I used to love that song, but no, this is a very Jewish looking body of work of looking at these events as the kosher history view of it. And so I just started digging into this more and more. And so we're going to run through some of this and see what you think. But, you know, like we always say at the Breakfast Club, we either start at the end of the last great ice age of what we call the great year in our Breakfast Club model, our nine-layer model, or we start at the beginning of the Piscean Age and move forward. With this, I'm going to go all the way back. And you know, the last great ice age, so like 50,000 to 22,000, you know, the great year before this last great year, we already had simple flutes in the archaeological record. You know, we have flutes that had modified scale capability from 65,000 BC forward. And so that's fascinating to me that as a people, we have not only had the desire to make whistles and sounds and musical tones, etc., but also had the ability to do so. So a lot of these simple flutes were made out of bone and other type materials, but a lot of them, like I said, were, you know, the early flutes were usually made out of a particular type of bone. But those, you know, go back in our records for a long time, that idea of the, you know, whistling fife for the flute. And then, you know, you move forward through our gold era, our silver era, copper era, into the iron era before you start to see the development of stringed. And so I think it's very interesting that, you know, they had such a gap there before you really started seeing a lot of string instruments. Once string instruments caught on, they went everywhere. And so in our iron era, which is, you know, 4000 BC to 2000 AD, the first part of it was the Age of Taurus from 4000 to 2000. And this is where you start to see metal develop. And also this is when people like Bishop Usher is putting the creation story of the Hebrews. So the Hebrew creation story and Genesis, all of that, they put that around 4000 BC. Okay, so when you look at the story of Genesis, one of the things that strikes out is in chapter 4, where it's talking about the lineage of Cain. And remember, Cain slew Abel and then was basically, you know, relegated to the shadows, the land of Nod, and became, you know, the killer enforcer, if you will. And then he had Lamech was the descendant. And there's a real curious part of the story of Lamech in chapter 4 where it talks about Lamech having two wives. The first wife was Ada, and the second wife was Zillah. And the first wife, Ada, had a son named Jabal, J-A-B-A-L, and he was the first tent and livestock person. So like the shepherd and the traveling tents kind of thing. And also Jubal. And so he was the first master of the lyre and flute. And then Zillah had the son Tubal-Cain, who was the first metalwork of especially a bronze and iron. And the image there is metalworking both for art, you know, with the bronze, but also metalworking in iron for weapons and tools. The second child from Zillah was Naamah, and she was, you know, Tubal-Cain's sister. Now, what's interesting about her is nothing is mentioned in that section of Genesis about her. But when you research her in Hebrew mythology, she basically is on par with Lilith. She's considered a demon that carries out all these horrible things, especially against children, causes children to have fits, etc. So just a very dark person, but that's Zilla's second child. And Tubal-Cain, of course, is revered by the Freemasons as being the father of Freemasonry. Then Jubal and Jabal are interesting because that's very similar to the three ruffians in the Masonic third act of Hiram Abiff being murdered at the temple by Jubalah, Jubalo, Jubalam, the three ruffians, the hidden hand outside of the 12 tribes of Israel. But so you have Jubal is the first master of the lyre and flute in that Hebrew mythology. Now, during this time period, the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Babylonians all developed some sort of harp or lyre stringed instrument, and then you started seeing a bowl-shaped acoustical resonator to amplify the sound. Now, in the Age of Aries, about 2000 BC to 0 AD, the developments in Egypt, you started to see tanbars or neck instruments appear as part of a musical ensemble. So this is moving forward from a traditional lyre or harp type instrument into what would become these guitar type instruments. And in 400 BC, the pandura appears in Greek culture, and it's again a neck stringed instrument, very similar to a lute. Then the Iron Era, of course, the third part is the Piscean Age, 0 AD to 2000 AD, the Piscean Age, and like we always talk about, 70 AD, the temple was destroyed at Jerusalem, and that war never ended. That's what we have to get our heads around, that war with Rome and the Jews never ended, 70 AD. Now, in 711, the Moors would bring their ode to conquered Spain, and an ode is very much like a lute, you know, some differences, but then that's the beginning of that migration of that type of instrument, the bowl-back parabolic reflector, if you will, type of shape for amplification of these stringed instrument. By 1100, Spain had become known for its manufacture of these type of stringed instruments. In 1680, during the Renaissance, Italians like Antonio Stradivarius began making five-string type or guitar-type instruments. Then in 1850, Spanish guitar maker Antonio Torres developed what would become the first modern six-string guitar. So that was in 1850, when you would see what we would consider the first modern guitar, six strings, fretted neck instrument with a soundboard and a sound chamber to resonate the music, and also that sound hole in those early guitars. Now, in 1876, remember, the telephone was invented. In 1878, the first telephone operator appeared. And in 1902, Henry Clausen invented what is known as the quarter-inch phonoplug. And if you want to know what that is, just ask a guitar player to show you an electric guitar cable sometime, because that quarter inch phono plug that was developed in 1902 would become the standard not only for telephone switchboard operator, but would also become used in the musical instrument world to connect guitars and basses, etc., to amplify, and also microphones to PA. So it's interesting that this quarter-inch phono jack, or what was called a TRS connect, would be developed for the phone network, but then since it was so readily available in these early attempts to make electric guitar, that's what the people used to make their connections, and it just stayed. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about the engineering behind the phone system was if they had done it with four wires, so you had two wires for send and two wires for receive, it wouldn't be that much of an engineering feat, but that would have really cost a lot more money and been cost prohibitive. The brilliance of the modern telephone company was that they figured out how to do the send and receive over a two-wire circuit so that you had both send and receive going over that two-wire circuit. And it was that same type of engineering that would go on to lay the foundations for the new electronic music industry for things like amplifiers, public address system, electric guitars, electric keyboard, you know, all of the connections that you saw in that early days of electronic music all kind of came out of the early days of the telephone. And so, of course, in this same lead up, you know, we had that World Zionist group coming in together. So again, in 1896, Theodore Herzl writes the Jewish state for Lord Rothschild. And in 1897, the World Zionist Congress met to decide how they were going to basically carry out this agenda to move back into Israel, set up Greater Israel, and become the sole superpower. And that's the other part of the story of the, you know, Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, is this is a conquest of these modern Maccabees. And so as this music industry's developed, you also have the rise of Zionism. And I guess it's interesting, I hadn't thought about this before just now, but also it's very telling that this was the rise of Zionism coinciding with the rise of cocaine use, and that cocaine use would become not only rampant with all of these Jewish philosophers like Freud, etc., and Bernays, but also with the musician that would really get addicted to cocaine. So this idea that all these systems were developing same times and had a lot of overlap is very telling. In 1896, Orville Gibson established Gibson Guitars in Kalamazoo, Michigan. In 1900, Christian Frederick Martin, or C.F. Martin, moved from Germany to the United States and began reinforcing guitars by using steel strings. So instead of using catgut string like those early guitars, C.F. Martin figured out how to, using modern woodworking techniques, well, these new modern tools and also modern glues and finish, where you could get a stronger glue seal on these guitars and still let them resonate, he was able to start using steel strings. And that's a lot of tension and a lot of stress. When you look at the physics of a guitar string, it's amazing how much force is being exerted on those wood joints on that guitar. And so he was one of the first to do that. Of course, 1914 is when World War I started and ran to 1918. In 1920, guitar designer Lloyd Loar joins Gibson and creates the first F-hole jazz guitar. So instead of having a center hole in the middle of the guitar, you had the sound coming out of what was called F-holes on the sides, and that became kind of the standard guitar for the new jazz move. And it's interesting to see when you read history as put forth to you by, say, public television in the United States, people like Ken Burns, for example, they talk about how wonderful the jazz movement was, etc. But in classic music circles, the jazz movement was seen as basically, you know, cultural warfare. And so when you read what especially the German philosophers and the National Socialists had to say of their analysis of the jazz movement, it was very unfavorable. The lot of concern by both the musicians, classical musicians, and behavioral psychologists and psychiatrists of the syncopated rhythm of jazz, and then the morph into what we would call rock and roll, but that you now had special drum kits being developed that were designed for a stationary drummer, not a marching drummer anymore or an orchestral percussionist, but a sitting drummer, to have the entire drum kit based around a kick and a snare to get that backbeat rhythm, as it was called, that syncopated rhythm, and then the hi-hat cymbals where you're getting your one and two rhythm from, you know, the one and two and three and four. Yeah, that was coming off your hi-hat, and then of course your cymbals and toms, etc., for flourishing. But it was all based around this musical style using a syncopated rhythm between a low-frequency kick drum, bass drum, and a higher-frequency snare drum. In 1936, Gibson introduced the ES-150 model guitar, and this is like the first mass-produced electric guitar with an electric pickup, and this was the guitar that made Charlie Christian famous. You know, they put him out playing this new style of music on this new technology influenced guitar, that you have a guitar with a pickup in it going to an amplifier, and that happened in 1936. Now, from the late 30s to the early 40s, a lot of people experimented with taking the sound hole out of guitars completely and just having a solid body guitar with a pickup. So people like Les Paul, Leo Fender, Paul Bigsby, O.W. Appleton, etc., all had claims of being the first to do it. That's definitely a religious war there between guitar players as who had the first workable solid body electric pickup guitar. Now, another key thing that was happening amongst this time period between the war was in 1923 when Rabbi Meir Shapiro began what was known as Daf Yomi. This was, of course, 1923, and I think this was one of the most overlooked power centers of the World Zionist Movement, because what he did was say, we're going to set up a daily reading of the Talmud, and we're going to spread this out over a 7.5-year cycle, but what we're going to do is use these modern media and coordinate all these international Jews, all these rabbis, and all these synagogues, and all of these Kabbalistic scholars, etc., and we're all going to read the same Talmudic passage on the same day. And so anybody who knows networking knows that the key to making any network functional, be it a telephone network or a computer network, is the clocking. And so I've always maintained that this, you know, act in 1923 of this Rabbi Shapiro was the clocking of the World Zionist Movement, because it brought all of these people with a single purpose, this Maccabee purpose of next year in Israel, you know, that we're going to take back, you know, the promised land, we're going to reestablish a Jewish homeland, and we're going to be the rulers of this planet. You know, that was all coming together, and they were coordinating by this use of Daf Yomi, or however you pronounce it, but it's a 7.5-year Talmudic reading cycle. And just to give you an idea of how powerful this system became, in 2012, over 90,000 Jews attended a New Jersey MetLife Stadium final page of a 7.5-year cycle. And that was just the ones that showed up at that stadium. You had people all around the world that were hooked up with this last page, first page, because what they did is they finished the Talmud, and then they immediately started over with the next 7.5-year cycle. But this gives you an idea. 90,000 people at the MetLife Stadium in 2012, and millions doing the same thing worldwide. So that all started in 1923. Now, in 1939 to 1945 was, of course, World War II. And right there at the end of World War II, Alistair Ian Al Stewart was born in Glasgow, Scotland. His father, Alistair McKitchen Stewart, died in a Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve training exercise, and so he never knew his father. So his father died before he was born, and right after that, the family moved to Dorset, England. Okay. Now, one of the things that I guess for somebody who grew up listening to modern music and buying albums and collecting albums and CDs and videos, etc., and having my favorite band is going back and revisiting all that material and realizing how Jewy-chewy, as I say, it is today. That, you know, you're sitting there realizing that, okay, well, that person turned out to be this, you know, hardcore Zionist who really is pushing this anti-white genocide agenda and this pro-Israel agenda. But yet at this point in my life, I thought they were the best thing ever. And so what's curious is how much these people, especially the celebrity performers, try to hide their Jewish heritage and that they don't talk about it. It's not in the official biography. You know, they never say it. So a lot of times you have to figure out, you know, by other sources, whether or not they were Jewish or just Zionist or just that useful idiot going along with the official story because it was popular. And so one of the things with this family is the Stewart family is, okay, you say you were born in Scotland and you were an English performer, but what does that mean? And why do you have the worldview you have if you are indeed Scottish or if you are indeed British? You know, it seems your worldview would be different. And the same goes with Lawrence Juber, who was born on the 12th of November 1952 in London, England, and they always bill him as an English musician. Now, these two gentlemen would go on to become two of those musicians, guitar player, where they did, you know, when you go back and look at their biographies, it's amazing who all they worked with as session musicians, who all they toured with, which albums they were on, who produced their records, etc. And it's really a who's who of the music industry. And so you think, okay, so you have this one person, Al Stewart, that was born in Scotland in 1945, and this other gentleman, Lawrence Juber, that was born in London, England in 1952. How did they come together and collaborate on a piece of work in 1995 that would have such a Zionist view of the events that happened between the two wars? And so this is why I called this episode, you know, Maccabee Life Between the Wars, because we always hear about European life between the wars. I heard, you know, what were the French feeling in that period between the war? What were the English? What were the Russians? What were the Germans? You know, all of these different groups. But, you know, what's never talked about is this movement of Zionism and all of these Zionist groups that were getting together and causing worldwide revolution and destroying the old order, destroying things like Christianity, destroying things like royalty and the so-called noble lines of Europe. And that is the part that is completely left out of this work that they released in 1995. Now, it's interesting that the film Exodus was released in 1960 of The Birth of Israel. How important that was to this next generation of Maccabee, that, you know, you had the generation that got together with Theodor Herzl, and then you had the group that got together and orchestrated, you know, the Balfour Declaration, for example, and then you had the group that did all the machinations of World War II, and then the establishment of Israel out of occupied Palestine, and then, of course, you know, the Holocaust narrative and how that entered in, and how suddenly you've got all of these Holocaust museums all around the world, and it's mandatory education for the student. And suddenly you've got Israel is America's best friend, and we're supposed to protect Israel at all costs. And then we have 9/11, and then we have the Odin-Yenin Wars, and it just kept escalating. And these same people just never seem to write songs about any of those Jewish things. But they write lots of songs about Goyim issues or Gentile issues. In the same time period as, you know, the Exodus film is released to the world of this, you know, Jews coming back to their holy land and establishing Israel, you had what was called in the music industry and the media industry the British invasion of the United States. And a lot of people peg that date as being, you know, December or November 1963 when the Beatles released I Want to Hold Your Hand in the UK and the USA, respectively. You know, November 63 in the UK, December 63 in the USA. And a lot of people say that was the official start of the British invasion. So you think of all we know about the Frankfurt School and then about the Tavistock Tavistock Institute and this development of this new type of amplified music that is being imported and this new media of radio and record player and magazine, glossy magazines, and entertainment section newspapers and getting around the old cultural boards of an area by instead of trying to put these bands into the music hall and the auditoriums with this amplified music. Instead, you are bringing them into sports arena. And you think, you know, now how much of the sports industry was controlled by Jewish interests even back then so that you could bring these rock and roll acts into these sports arenas, like the Beatles went into Shea Stadium, for example. You know, how were everybody working together to make that happen when you had people at, you know, the local community culture boards, etc., that were very much against these type of programs. And I always thought it was interesting that in Israel, the Beatles were banned because all the elders consider it degenerate. And so the Beatles were banned in Israel throughout until much, much later, throughout the entire British invasion. You know, that was one of the big things that all those book, you know, bands were not allowed in Israel. But yet you had all these Jewish music producers, etc., promoting them both in the UK, exporting them into places like Hamburg, Germany, but also into the United States and actually calling it the British invasion. And when you see how tightly the entertainment industry in the United States, like in New York and in Hollywood and Nashville, worked with these groups coming out of London that were pushing all of these bands, and also the media. And so you see this concerted effort of Jewish interests to carry out this British invasion. And, you know, looking at it now, what we know about asymmetrical warfare and psychological warfare, it definitely changed the culture. If you think how much culture has changed since the first Beatles performance in 1963 of I Want to Hold Your Hand, it definitely keeps in with that idea of, you know, demoralization of country that the ex-KGB person told us about in the 80s when he defected. It's like, this is, you know, how you go in and demoralize a country. So in the development, of course, you got more and more sophisticated, you know, like I said, we moved from AM radio to FM radio. And in 1973, the eighth James Bond film was released, and ex-Beatle Paul McCartney or William Campbell or Bill or Beetle Bill, whatever, did the theme song of Live and Let Die. And in 76, Al Stewart released Year of the Cat, and it was produced by Alan, produced and engineered by Alan Parsons. And for the musicians and fans out there, Alan Parsons is another one of those people who has produced and worked with everybody. And that album went on to win the Platinum Album of the Year. It's interesting, in 77, Lawrence Juber did the Bond film for that year, which was the 10th Bond film, The Spy Who Loved Me. And he would then work with Ringo Starr on the Stop and Smell the Roses album. And in 78, he would end up joining Paul McCartney and Wings and work with them until 1981. Al Stewart in 78 released his album Time Passages, and in 81, Lawrence Juber moved to the USA to meet Hope Schwartz, whose father happened to be TV producer Sherwood Schwartz, who got his start in TV in Hollywood, first writing for the Bob Hope radio show, then for the Ozzie and Harriet show, the model American 50s family, Ozzie and Harriet. Then he worked for Armed Forces Radio, U.S. Armed Forces Radio, and his big break came in 1964 when he produced the long-running sitcom Gilligan's Island, and then in 1969 when he did The Brady Bunch. And so that is Lawrence Juber's father-in-law. And so once he, you know, came out to L.A., he got lots of work, thanks to his father-in-law, working on the music for the sitcoms Happy Days, Family Ties, Home Improvement, and Seventh Heaven, just to name a few. He also did the 1988 Very Brady Christmas. Now, so you see that, you know, again, music industry, when you get at that level, it's a very small group of people that are very, very powerful and very, very connected and often very, very Jewish. Now, in 1995, Al Stewart and Lawrence Juber came together to put out an album called Between the Wars, which covered the history from 1918 to 1939. The first song on the album is called Night Train to Munich, and it's supposed to be about the 1940 film directed by Carol Reed, starring Rex Harrison, and it's about the cloak and dagger world of the spy in the time of these governments basically realizing they have a Jewish problem and a communist problem, a Bolshevik problem, and trying to figure out what to do about it. And so this song is all about the viewpoint of the Jew trying to be moved into Munich by this network of the underground. So it's very interesting that that is the song. You always think about Bolshevik terrorist mass murderer Trotsky in his autobiography talking about how he was moved through Europe into Russia to set up all the preliminary groundwork for the Bolshevik Revolution, and how the police and the Freemason would move him and all this using secret codes and formulas and to communicate clandestinely in the beginning of the intelligence world, if you will. Then the second track is called The Age of Rhythm, which is an homage to the black jazz world that was developing in the United States during this time. And then track three is a song called Sampan, which is the Chinese flat bottom boat that is, you know, used with a pole instead of an oar usually. And one of the things not talked about in that song is just how ruthlessly the rise of the Communist Party in China came into power in 1921, and by 1927 Mao Zedong had controlled the party, and then the Chinese Civil War from 27 to 49, and just how many millions of people were killed in that cultural war. And yet, you know, the Sampan is this song about just, you know, opening up relations with the East. So a very deceptive song about the, you know, versus the reality of what was going on in China between World War One and World War Two. Track four is called Lindy Comes to Town, and it's kind of an homage, but a little tongue-in-cheek taken a dig at Charles Lindbergh and his first solo flight in the Spirit of St. Louis from Long Island, New York to Paris at the age of 25 in 1927. And then another part of the song, he even talks about the upcoming ticker tape parade not seeing the crash of 29 that's coming. And so it's like the celebration of Lindbergh, but just you wait, you won't be celebrating in a couple of years kind of thing. And what we know now about the so-called Great Depression was that was all synthetic. You know, thanks to the Federal Reserve of 1913, you know, that was a complete manipulation of the markets. And you saw that the old WASP families, the all Catholic families that had built up the fortunes of the Great Republic, those were the ones who lost the most, while your Jewish interests, your Zionist interests, people working with the Zionists, those are, and your Freemasons, those were the ones that benefited from the stock market crashes. And also just how many Gentile banks went out during that period. Track five is called Three Mules, and this is a song that takes a dig at the UK Prime Ministers Ramsay MacDonald, Stanley Baldwin, and Neville Chamberlain for failing to prepare Europe and England for what Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists were supposedly doing in Germany, and that their idea of appeasement is what caused the Holocaust, basically. So it's another one of those, the Gentiles didn't do enough to protect the Jews of Europe, and if these three prime ministers had done more, then Hitler would have never been able to do what the Jews said he did, kind of thing. So, that's a very telling song about, this idea of the Gentiles can never do enough to protect and please the Jews, and always somebody has to be at the blame. And so they're just really digging at these prime ministers. And track six is called The League of Nations, which is a take off of the League of Nations of 1919. Also the Treaty of Versailles, of basically the post-World War I redrawing of the map of Europe and the Middle East. And one of the things that's not talked about is any Jewish interest. He makes fun of everyone else, from Churchill's 14 points to Clemenceau saying God himself had only 10, talking about the French interest in the League of Nations, and all these other digs, but no mention at all of the Balfour Declaration, Jews moving into Palestine, also any of the attacks by the Irgun, the Schirn Gang, all these other Jewish gangs in that. But again, conspicuous by its absence of mention is anything to do with Rothschild's role in this or the Zionists in this. But this is the remapping of Europe, and it's all about the Americans and the English and the French that are doing, kind of thing. Then, of course, track seven is Life Between the Wars, where it's just kind of an montage of people that were celebrities at the time. And many of the people were, of course, these Jewish communist writers and so-called artists that were very active during this time in these various revolutions. And these are the people that are cited with honors, if you will. This is the homage to them. And so it's interesting to go through the list of why does he think this person is so great? Why is this person so great? Track eight is Betty Boop's Birthday, which was an instrumental. And Betty Boop was a early animation character created by Jew Max Fleischer, and was the image of the Jazz Age flapper, that modern Millie type woman, the independent woman who ran off from the farm to go to the lights of the city and going to make it on her own and spend her time, going to the jazz clubs, etc. And so that was, the Betty Boop type image, always surrounded by wolves type thing. He also did Coco the Clown, Popeye, and Superman cartoons, and was responsible for the Bouncing Ball sing-along film. He moved from the U.S. in 1887 to New York from Poland. And his caricature of Betty Boop was based on Helen Kane, who did the song I Want to Be Loved by You. It's kind of the early flapper femme fatale radio voice in that early glamorization of the celebrities of Hollywood in this new market of media, if you will. Then track nine is Marion the Chatelaine, and this was about William Randolph Hearst's mistress, Marion Davies. And again, it uses the song to talk a lot about Randolph Hearst. So it's interesting that they would have such a negative image of him, but yet no mention of all these other Hollywood moguls and Jewish power brokers and their mistresses, etc. So I thought that was interesting. Then track 10, I think, is where it's really telling, where they talk about Joe the Georgian. And this is a song that talks of the betrayed Soviet officers waiting in hell for Joseph Stalin to arrive. And it goes through they had the great plan, and Lenin was leading us to victory, but then he took the fever and it was hijacked by Stalin, who then threw everybody else over the side, and so they never got a chance to do communism the way it should have been done, type of thing, because Joseph Stalin ruined everything for them. So Joe the Georgian is a very telling song on the album. Track 11 is Always the Cause, and it deals with the Spanish Civil War. And again, this is that realization that all through my elementary school and high school and college and university, and all the art and media I was exposed to, it's interesting, you always get the Jewish communist version of the Spanish Civil War, that it was this great failure and that all these great people went across and sacrificed, but they all lost and came back to the United States and, lamented that, because they lost in Spain, that allowed Adolf Hitler to rise in Germany, etc. And he pays particular attention to Isadora Gomez, who was one of the communist leaders in the Spanish Civil War. And she's known for her No Pasarán comment, or They Shall Not Pass, in the Battle of Madrid in 1936. She was exiled from Spain after the war until 1977, and was allowed back in then. And we've seen what's happened in Spain, since the 70s, and really seeing, the Jews not only being allowed back into Spain, but now, the Spanish government are being required to grovel and apologize for things like the Spanish Inquisition, etc., and the Spanish Civil War. The other mention in the song is Guernica by Pablo Picasso, and it talks about the bombing of the town of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War in April of 1937, and Picasso completed his work in June of 1937, and it was, a huge mural, so 137 inches by 305, and that supposedly captured the spirit of the Spanish Civil War. And then the 12th track is Laughing Into 1939, and talking about just that the black cloud of the next war looming while everyone is basically partying, and the post-depression age, the the market's booming, etc., type thing. But bad days are coming, because, we have to go stop the National Socialists in Germany and Italy. And then the last track, track 13, is a very haunting instrumental called the Black Danube. And of course, the Danube River is the second largest river in Europe and originates in Germany's Black Forest. And the idea of the Black Danube is the war coming and the river's running with blood, type of thing. And the illusion, though, is it's all about the Jewish suffering and the communist suffering at the hand of the National Socialists. Those were the 13 songs, and it's so fascinating to think that, coming out of, the educational system that I did, and being exposed to all this media all my life, be it from film, from music, the radio, albums, records, etc., that in 1995, that album was pretty much, how I had been taught all those events, and also what I should feel about those events, that these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. That, of course, the National Socialists in Germany were the worst things ever, and World War II was all their fault, never mind that the Jews declared war first. This was what, we were raised on. And so it's after last week's show, when people, just really started acknowledging that the 1930s was such a key decade, that period between the wars especially, but the 1930s, we really need to go back and look at those events and see, what the big events were and what we were told the big events were, and how that's very, very different, and how this Jewish-controlled media even then was slanting the narrative and marketing to us this view that we were supposed to have, and it was being reinforced by all of these celebrities. And like we say, you know, these are the best of the best. When you have people like, you know, Al Stewart and Lawrence Juber, you know, those were some real heavy hitters putting out what was considered, you know, a classic concept album at the time that got critical acclaim, even though it didn't sell a lot of copies, just award winning. But yet, you know, like we always say, 9/11 changed everything. And so we go back and we look at those events again and have to adjust our Overton window accordingly. So with that said, you've been listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. I'd like to thank you all again for coming to the Trading Post this evening and sharing your wacky Wednesday with me. And until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive if the stock market tanks? Look, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation, and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now, or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over 6 decades' experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge, and I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for private consultation. Once again, our phone number is 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
I'm so excited to have you as part of the Wild Pastures family, and we look forward to bringing you the pasture-raised meats that you and your family will love. Now, we started Wild Pastures because so many of my clients would tell me they just couldn't find high-quality pasture-raised meats, and even when they did, it was so expensive that they couldn't afford to eat it regularly. Now, I'm not talking about the bottom-of-the-barrel healthy meats that have claims like natural or free-range or even cage-free, terms that were actually created by the industrial food industry to make us feel all warm and fuzzy about buying their low quality products. I'm talking about truly nourishing pasture-raised meats, the kind that you'll never really find in a grocery store. Our farmers are doing things beyond organic. Our beef is 100% grass-fed and grass-finished and raised on pastures free from chemicals and other pesticides. Our chickens are 100% pasture-raised, where they get their natural diet of grass and forage and insects. We will never settle for free range, which is actually one of the most deceptive terms in the chicken industry. In fact, less than 0.1% of the chicken consumed in the United States is truly pasture-raised in the way that ours is. And our pork is 100% pasture-raised as well. So if you care about where your food comes from, then you have definitely made it to the right place. As a Wild Pastures member, you'll be supporting the most highly principled farmers in America and getting the most nutrient-dense, nourishing, and sustainable meats in the world. I'm confident you'll love being part of our mission at Wild Pastures, and you will really love the delicious, nourishing meats that we're going to deliver straight to your door.
Visit republicbroadcasting.org and click the Wild Pastures banner ad. Secure a shipment today. Beef, poultry, and pork. Raised the way nature intended.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau de Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com. Or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113. DrinkSuperTea.com.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Hey there, are you going to wait till the cows come home to get your new Ease-Off drop-in lift?
What in the world is an Ease-Off drop-in lift?
Our Ease-Off is a new tool to increase production for your meat processing company that will get that whole hog or half a beef on or off your rail with our remote control.
That sounds great, but can I afford it?
Sure, and the Ease-Off installs fast. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue, speed up your line, and increase profits.
Okay, I'm convinced. Where can I get my Ease-Off?
Go to EaseOff.com. That's EAZEOFF.com. And hurry, because we're offering free shipping for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932-6419.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.